Welcome to this new podcast. My name is Anna Bull and I'm a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Portsmouth. And I'm also a co-director of the 1752 Group, a research and campaign group tackling the issue of staff sexual misconduct in higher education. And you can read more about our work at www.1752group.com or follow us on Twitter. So this is the first ever podcast, possibly the only ever podcast from the 1752 Group. And by way of a trigger warning, just to say we will be discussing topics relating to sexual violence and harassment, although this podcast is going to focus on institutional responses and legal challenges rather than discussing sexual harassment or violence itself. So I was compelled to record this podcast after reading Julie McFarlane's book, Going Public, A Survivor's Journey from Grief to Action, published last year by BTL Books. Julie McFarlane was until recently Professor of Law at the University of Windsor, but has now left in disgust after some events that she describes in her book. She's researched and written extensively on dispute mediation, self-represented litigants, and the legal profession. She was named as a member of the Order of Canada in 2020 and got in touch with us at the 1752 Group a couple of years ago when she started campaigning on NDAs as a result of her own experiences, which we'll talk about today. So she's therefore in a unique position of being both a campaigner working on addressing sexual misconduct in institutions, but also a law professor with a deep expertise in relevant topics. So welcome, Julie.
Thanks, Anna.
So I wanted to do this podcast about her book, first of all, because it's a brilliant read for anyone who likes accounts of feminists triumphing over institutions. And I really feel like it is going to be made into a movie at some point, at least I hope so, because there were several punching the air moments for me where Julie won her battles. But quite apart from that, as a researcher and campaigner, I felt there were various tactics and ideas in the book that deserve further discussion and attention, and we'll be focusing on those today. So to discuss the book with Julie and I, I'm really delighted to welcome Georgina Calvert-Lee, Head of UK Practice at McAllister Olivarius. Georgina has been at the forefront of legal action against higher education institutions in the UK in relation to their handling of sexual misconduct complaints, among a variety of other forms of equalities litigation. At the 1752 Group, we had the privilege of working with her on our complaints process guidance, outlining how universities should handle staff to student sexual misconduct complaints, published last year and available on our website. Georgina is a leading voice in the fight for justice for sexual misconduct complainants within education institutions, and it's no exaggeration to say that she is personally responsible for making several institutions in the country safer places to work and study. So welcome, Georgina.
Gosh, thanks for that, Anna. That's very generous.
So yeah, just to start us off, Julie, I've got a few things that I want to cover. But could you start by telling us what made you want to write this book?
Well, this book was a very long time in gestation, and it's unlike anything I've ever written before. I've written academic books based on my research, always with a lot of story narrative for many, many years now. But the story narrative here is me, which felt like a very surreal thing to be doing. But I felt that my experience of both the sexual violence and abuse that I had endured when I was younger, which I think is, in fact, not unusual at all. Perhaps in my case, unusual insofar as there was a lot of it, but not really that unusual. But I felt that the way that I then decided to process it, both publicly about it, initially in my own law school, and then by bringing legal action against the Church of England, was a story that I wanted to tell, because having conducted research for many years with people who've gone through the civil litigation system and listened to their stories of the horror that that can be, it was somehow a different level to experience it myself. And I felt that I could have some credibility in my critique of this experience because of my previous work as a researcher and as a law professor. So it sort of brought all those pieces together for me.
Yeah, and I have to say, it's an incredible read.
Thank you, Anna.
I agree, Georgina.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, I'd want to bring you in a minute, Georgina, but I guess one of the first themes I wanted to talk about was as an activist was the idea around settlements. Maybe that's starting at the end of the process, but you know, that's kind of one of the places that we can change. So the book outlines legal actions you've been involved with, in against both the Anglican Church and also against your university in Canada. So to start with the Anglican Church in the UK, one of the discussions I found most fascinating in the book was around the way you used the settlement process with the church to actually get changes made to the complaints process and the experience for complainants. And given that very few sexual harassment cases actually make it to tribunals and most cases settle in some form, this is a really great tool for activists, I think. And in the process, you achieved what in your book you say the Church Times has described as a bill of rights for claimants. So could you explain a little bit how you use the settlement process to try and make change, and also perhaps explain for a layperson exactly what, you know, what a settlement is?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, it sounds so strange to me hearing you asking me about, you know, my law cases, because I have spent about 30 years of my academic work basically writing about how terrible litigation is and how nobody in their right mind would probably ever want to do it, because it's a very uncertain and often a very traumatizing and very expensive process. So it was a real, it was a huge step for me to decide that I was going to use the civil process. And the reason that I did that was because I became convinced from an activist perspective that the way to hold, in this case, the first case, the Church of England to account, would be for many people to bring cases, for those cases to get public attention. And I also felt that I was in a sort of different position because of the work that I did in bringing a case forward as a plaintiff. The solicitor who represented me in that case, the amazing David Greenwood, told me that when I first contacted him, in terms of, you know, myself as a client, he said it was like Christmas, because I had someone who understood the process and would be able, you know, to sort of navigate it along with me. And, you know, I can't really justify law professors having any special credibility, but in our society, they do. So that was going to be to my advantage. But right from the very beginning, what I was interested in was using the case to hold the church to account in a very public way. So I think it's fair to say that that was, you know, the strategic basis on which I went into this. I wasn't interested. I remember saying again very early on to David, I hope you're not going to suggest to me that I sign a non-disclosure agreement. And he just laughed and said, no, 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 I know that's not what you want to do here, because the whole point of this was to be public. I was therefore thinking from the very beginning that my challenge was to get the church to talk to us. And this is the kind of challenge that people face all the time when they bring cases against institutions for either historical, contemporary sexual abuse or violence. The challenge, we all know that 95% plus of these cases settle, but the challenge is when. And unfortunately, there is often a tactic used by many of these institutions, or I'd say all of them, to delay that process. And in the course of that, over what can be several years, plaintiffs become very exhausted. They become very tired. And in my case, I had exactly the same experience. I naively imagined that they would talk to us, and of course, they didn't. We filed a claim, they filed a defense, which was a pretty distressing thing to read. And I couldn't figure out how to get them to talk to us. So my strategy for that, and again, I think this is important as part of a sort of overall activism here, was I Googled one night and discovered that the Church Times is the world newspaper of the Anglican Church. It goes to Anglicans all over the world. So I wrote the editor that night and proposed that I write a piece about my case. And I had a fantastic response. I have nothing but respect for the editorial leadership of the Church Times. And I published that piece, and immediately the church was in touch and they wanted to talk to us. And then when we started to talk about settlement, I told them right up front that I was, you know, I wanted money to pay for David's time. He'd been doing this work, obviously, on contingency without payment. But my most important goal here was to change the process, because I had already endured, by this point, almost 2 years of going through that process. And I could see how incredibly discouraging it would be for anyone to come forward and then to be faced with these, you know, classic outdated responses around consent mythology, statute of limitations, claiming it was too long ago, all of the kinds of devices that institutions use to avoid. But they will eventually settle. So we did eventually sit down and have a conversation. And I said, I want a new claims process. I want to sit down and take apart the current process that the insurer pushes people through, because this was obviously dealing with an insurance company, and to think of ways in which that process can be made more humane and more supportive, and in which the use of these kinds of outdated defenses that are so offensive to survivors can be reduced. And so it took a while for them to believe me. They seemed, to begin with, they were sort of, oh yes, okay, we can talk about that at the end. I was like, no, that is what we're talking about. And it took several repeats for that message to get through. They were sort of scratching their heads. And I've done a lot of work designing complaints processes in my work as a dispute resolution person. So we then set up a series of meetings at which we actually did the design of the new process that resulted in what you called, Anna, the Bill of Rights. And it's a much better process. And some of those things are very tangible. For example, now they have agreed that everybody who brings a complaint will be immediately offered counseling, paid for by the church, regardless of whether or not they think there's a merit in the claim. So there were some important pieces in there, but we have to stay on the case of the insurance company to make sure that they actually deliver in practice.
I mean, I find that incredibly inspiring. And I know that, you know, if we think about translating that mode of activism to the higher education context, there's a lot of challenges because we don't have one centralized authority. We have a lot of institutions that are very proud of their autonomy. But I guess, Georgina, you know, to bring you in, you know, is this an approach that is widely used? I know it's something that, you know, an approach that you've taken. And does it have the potential to be used more often?
I think it certainly has a potential to be used more often. And I think the way, Julie, you've publicized it is really instrumental, or I hope will be instrumental in encouraging other people to do the same. I don't think it is widely used. I think that's probably why the attitude or the response of the defense attorneys, lawyers, was to scratch their head when you say it. They think that everything can be reduced to money because, of course, litigation, the currency of litigation is money. You're suing for damages, and often that's really not enough. That's not what people want, although it helps. It shouldn't be forgotten. But the wonderful thing about settling, if you can get beyond those absolutely routine, almost template defenses that come out, which are highly disrespectful, and I mean, that's an understatement of the year, but they're sort of injurious in themselves to the plaintiff or the claimant, to say that they might have consented. I mean, I've seen in a child abuse case a 14-year-old girl, in fact, the judge accepting, this is one that went to trial, the judge accepting or really being instrumental in guiding the defense, that he thought a 14-year-old girl was so sophisticated because she went to private school and her father was a solicitor, that she most likely manipulated the 30-year-old employee who raped her. But, you know, go figure. And that's where we are when some of these things go to trial. And so sometimes they actually work. So they are template defenses, but because, very sadly, in our system, they seem to work because of all the prejudices which you outlined so well in your book, Julie. That was sort of brilliantly done. Anyway, back to your question, Anna. Sometimes it does work. I mean, I'm often representing clients, and it has to be client-led, because for some people, actually, they just need the money and they don't want to advocate. That's not what they're about. And that's perfectly fine. It shouldn't be on their shoulders to do that. But if they are strong enough to do that and they have the sort of voice and articulation, which you clearly have, Julie, it's great when they can. And I'm thinking back to another, or you remind me of one of my clients Emma Chapman, an academic who you know well, Anna, too, and who was a founding member of the 1752 group, I think, who was herself had a grievance and was came to a settlement and refused, staunchly refused, to sign an NDA. And part of her grievance was about the overuse and abuse and misuse of NDAs. So the notion that she would be subjected to one just seemed extraordinary to have asked. So, of course, Emma pushed back on this. No, she wouldn't sign it, very bravely, because they retorted, well, God, you have to. That's the way it is. A settlement means an NDA, which, of course, it doesn't. A settlement settles a claim. It doesn't, shouldn't ensure your silence. That's a totally different thing. Emma stood her ground, and eventually, after all the stakeholders and various obstacles were put in the way, eventually the obstacles were removed, because actually they did want to settle, come what may. And that's, I'm sure there were people working hard behind the scenes there. So I don't want to sort of underestimate the work of people within the institution. There are often well-meaning people within the institution trying to bring about change. And after that, we were told, and I don't know whether it's, you know, I have no way of auditing to see if this has been carried on by the university, but we were told, and they told actually the Guardian, I think, that they weren't going to use NDAs ever again in settlements relating to bullying or harassment, which was a wonderful outcome. But as I say, I have no way of knowing whether that they were actually sticking to that. And we've tried this on other occasions, actually in the city. I've had a sort of employer, so outside the university context, client who's who has very much taken seriously the demand for donations to a charity and a complete overhaul in their complaint system. And that was very gratifying. And again, I think it's just that wonderful mix of having a claimant who is strong enough to demand it and committed enough to demand it. And then on the other side, you have to have someone who recognizes that they were in the wrong in this particular case, so they feel sort of guilty and that they need to make reparation. And then they have the moral fiber to be able to push it through on that side as well. So it does takes a combination of factors to make it work.
I think that's actually so important. I just want to add to that, to what Georgina just said, that I tried this strategy a second time, as you will know from reading my book, with my own university. And I know Emma, and it was in relation to NDAs as well. I began a lawsuit, the sole purpose of which was to persuade them to change their policy on NDAs. And flushed with my previous success, I thought, you know, we can make this happen. It was an abject failure. So I would just underscore what Georgina said. You know, if you're looking at this as an activist strategy, I think it really has a lot of potential, but it's not always going to work, because you have to have another side that is willing to take that step of saying, oh yeah, actually maybe this is in our interest too. I mean, I think what happened with the Anglican Church's insurance company is ICSA was going on, the Independent Inquiry into Institutionalized Child Abuse, and they realized that a lot of what I was telling them they needed to change, they were going to be told to do it anyway. And they saw an opportunity to get in there and do it, you know, and look good. I tried all of those same arguments on my own university, but I'm afraid they failed. But just one other thing that I think is important, again, from an activist perspective, and it builds on something Georgina said, is I don't think a lot of people know, and this is one of the points of the podcast for you, I think, Anna, that this is something that you can bring into a settlement discussion. You can bring anything into a settlement discussion. You know, you can bring in, you know, I want the other side to, you know, run back and forth on Westminster Bridge wearing purple for a week. I mean, you can ask for anything. It's not that you'll necessarily get it. But even though the legal system really, and I think for a lot of people who aren't familiar with the system, they believe that all they can ask for is money. In fact, you can ask for anything. Now, if you go to court and you have a trial, all you're going to get is money. You're not going to get an order making people do different things policy-wise. But in settlement, that's where the potential lies. And those are 95% of these cases.
Yeah, I think that chimes with my wider research with complainants, which shows that if they ever do get to the end of a complaints process internal to the university before a settlement or outside of a settlement, institutions seem to think that money, financial payouts, is the only kind of redress or remedy that is needed, whereas in fact there's a huge variety of redress that can and should be offered. So yeah, Julie, you've touched on the second point that I wanted to move on to perhaps, around your campaigning on NDAs. So for myself as a campaigner on staff sexual misconduct, one of the most fascinating things in the book is about your fight against a defamation suit. So after you were asked to give a reference for an ex-colleague who had actually in fact lost his job for sexually harassing students. Could you talk us through what happened here, Julie?
Well, I always think that this is, and again, a reason for writing about it, you know, you could not have made up a better example of why NDAs are so completely messed up. Not only are they, I think, immoral because they silence people, but and unnecessary, where you can still protect people's identity and anonymity without saying they can't talk about anything to do with the case. But this also shows how when they're used in universities, there are so many pitfalls. So my former colleague, was terminated by the university following an investigation into his sexual and other misconduct. Because we are in a unionized environment, he grieved and the university settled with him. And at this point, myself and the students that I'd worked with for over a year, almost two by this point, were relieved, delighted he was gone, until I started to hear from other law schools asking me why had he left, since he was a tenured professor. We have tenure in Canada, which makes you very secure. And why was he now applying to them, since they were considering his application for another position? And what was the background to why he had left the university, since it didn't seem to be explained anywhere? So, of course, I told them the truth. I told them he'd left as a result of this investigation, and I had firsthand knowledge, because I'd worked with the students, of his behavior, which was absolutely beyond appalling. And he then sued me for defamation. And the reason he was able to sue me for defamation, despite the fact that, of course, I was telling the truth, was because I didn't have access to any of the documents that showed that he had, in fact, been terminated for misconduct. The university had those hidden. They had the settlement agreement hidden. I eventually got hold of all these documents. They'd even given him a letter of recommendation, which is pretty hilarious when you put it side by side with the letter of termination. So because they weren't prepared to give up those documents, he was able to take me to court in Trinidad. I'm sure he chose Trinidad because if it had been my own home here in Ontario, we could have had students testify and subpoenaed people and so on and so forth. And he brought this lawsuit against me there. The university then refused to defend me and said that, I was not somehow covered by their insurance policy, which was clearly nonsense. And that was very quickly dealt with by my pro bono lawyer, who brought an application before an astonished Ontario Superior Court judge, who scratched her head and said, how is giving a reference not part of her employment? Of course she's covered by the insurance policy. So they were ordered to defend me. But what happened, in fact, was they threw the case. They didn't submit any evidence. They didn't conduct any cross-examination. And I was notified afterwards that there was a defamation order against me. So, you know, this shows the consequences of a non-disclosure agreement. I mean, the only way that this, I suppose, could have been avoided would have been for the president of the university to have written all the academic faculty and said, by the way, when you get a call about this guy, don't say anything, which of course he was never going to do. And I guess that what they were relying on, and this is the part that really breaks my heart, was that if people had received a call like this, and I believe others of my colleagues did, that they would simply obfuscate or, you know, say they couldn't help. I felt I had a moral obligation to tell the truth because I didn't want this guy being dumped on another set of law students in another law school, which was in fact what happened. So I think it's a classic tale of everything that's wrong with NDAs. It enables people to be moved from university to university, and it assumes the complicity of faculty members to hide the information. And I don't think that morally it's appropriate for me as a professor whose number one interest is the safety of my students to learn, to be part and complicit of that. So it fell apart. And I think that what they were relying upon was that I would just keep quiet about it all, and so would everybody else. They were right about the second, but not about the first.
I mean, I would say it's an extraordinary story, but unfortunately I'm familiar with a similar account.
Exactly.
From Carol Mundell. Carol Mundell, yeah. Professor of Extragalactic Astronomy here in the UK, who had a similar experience, which was reported in the media a few years ago, quite recently. I was going to ask you, Georgina, could this happen in the UK? But actually, quite clearly it can, and it does.
It's a rhetorical question.
Similar here.
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, it's all too frequent, and it comes up at every stage, really, the threat of defamation, that it's often used. Well, I've seen it even used in the grievance process, which of course is a confidential and you would anyway have qualified privilege in making allegations within that relatively secure process. And I've seen it as a retort by the employer to the employee who has made a grievance. So it starts at that level. I mean, not routinely, but it can happen then. And it can happen, I've seen it happen a lot in universities where students, so even undergraduates who have made a complaint of sexual violence, often sort of assault or rape, and they're just constantly warned. It's under the guise of a friendly word of advice by maybe their personal tutor or someone within their university saying, well, just be careful what you say, probably best not to talk to anyone about what's happened to you, because of course it could be defamatory. Well, it would be. It's usually posed as it would be defamatory. You'd be exposed to a claim of defamation if you talk about it on social media or anywhere. Of course, defamation is only actionable if it's untrue, if you say something that's not true about someone else. So by even warning someone, you're implicitly suggesting that you don't believe what they're saying is true. And that can be really injurious to the person it's told to, but also it terrifies the complainant, because it's often taken such courage to come forward and make a complaint in the first place. The idea that you then might be literally punished for it by your university, for, well, one, by the harasser or assailant who could sue you for defamation, when often they can't, but I mean that's the suggestion, and your university who might discipline you for breaching the code of conduct by saying something defamatory. So yes, I'm afraid I have seen that threat many times over, and it is wrong to overemphasize it, because truth is an absolute defense to defamation.
But of course,
the problem being that
in some cases people don't have access to the information that proves the truth, and that was, you know, the additional dimension. Here in Canada, there's a young woman who's just completed a doctoral thesis on people being sued for defamation by alleged perpetrators, and it's 20 something, and most of those are students. And it's being used as a threat to silence them, because of course the problem is that even if it is true, which it is in these cases, they can either not prove it, or even if they can prove it, they still go through this incredible trauma and anxiety is associated with being sued.
And then there are your cases. Sorry, Anna, just to sort of complete that. And then there are those uses of NDA, which actually stop you from being able to prove the truth. And it ties everyone up, even the university. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Anna.
I know that we are able to talk about NDAs for hours, because we have done in the past, quite recently.
And hopefully one day we'll never need to talk about them again.
That would be the dream, absolutely. But I guess, you know, Julie, I know you're campaigning on banning NDAs completely at the moment. There's, you know, it's kind of discussions around whether there should be a victim exception for NDAs, because NDAs could be between a perpetrator and their institution, or they could be between a victim or complainant and their institution. And some people argue that the victim complainant actually has some bargaining power. If she can sell her silence to the institution, she's more likely to get a settlement. But on the other side, you know, others argue, such as yourself, Julie, that and actually institutions want to settle. And trying to sell your silence, or having the option of selling your silence, isn't necessarily needed, and it's often used as a silencing tactic or as a threat tactic. Would you like to say a little bit more about your campaign, Julie, and how it's going?
Sure. We're not officially launched yet, but I'm working on this with Zelda Perkins and allies, including Georgina and many others in, I think we're up to 7 different countries now that we're having discussions with, because the problems are so similar everywhere. And you're right, Anna, that this is often framed as victims' right to sell their silence. But when I have sort of dug deeper into this and thought further about this and talked with many people who are very experienced, including Georgina and others, this is what you start to see. First of all, as we've already said, this is a default. And I hate to say this about the legal profession, but there's a certain amount of laziness here. Everybody always asks for an NDA in these circumstances. And there is a sort of a complicit culture around that, because it just makes life more straightforward for everybody. And I get contacted now regularly by women without legal backgrounds who are represented by lawyers who've signed NDAs. And they are told all the time that this is the only option they have. This will help them to move on with their lives. This is an expression I've started to come to hate, because what these women tell me over and over again is that it did the opposite. It meant that they felt that they had kind of the sword of Damocles hanging over their heads if they talked at all about their experience. As you've already said, Anna, and we've talked about earlier, almost all these cases settle anyway. And if they didn't settle, then there would be publicity in any case for the institution, because unless it was a private arbitration, this would be in tribunal or court, and it would be in the public domain. So there's a way in which this is a kind of insidious calling of a bluff, you know, because if you just keep pushing back and saying, no, I don't want to sign that, they don't want to be in a public arena either, because they don't want people to know about this. And finally, I think it's really important to know that we can protect identity for people who want their privacy to remain without necessarily making them be gagged about every single other aspect of their case. And we can protect one side without protecting the other. I mean, there's this assumption that an NDA is mutual, so that the perpetrator or the university, whoever was on the other side, would also be guaranteed silence and non-disclosure. But there's no reason why it should be mutual. And I personally believe that any kind of a non-disclosure agreement that has what I would call public implications, public safety, public risk, public interest implications, which would certainly include moving a known perpetrator to another place, should not be lawfully enforceable. You know, these NDAs began with trade secrets. And I think that in their original format as trade secret protection, especially in the beginnings of the tech boom, they made a certain amount of sense. But there is no way that I think you should be able to legally or morally support a non-disclosure agreement that brings in some kind of public risk, public safety. And we're talking about people who have left workplaces with, you know, racism. A history of racism, a history of bullying, a history of harassment, to move them secretively when all you want to do, all you really need to do is protect the victim's personal identity, is completely unnecessary. And I think it should be unlawful.
Yeah, so as I said, we have been having these extensive discussions already. But Georgina, did you have anything to add to those points?
Well, I mean, apart from being able to talk all night about this, I do think institutions will settle because they want to settle. And if they're not allowed to settle with an NDA, then of course they'll settle without an NDA. It will just take that whole thing off the table. And currently they're not allowed to have an NDA that precludes you from making a whistleblowing complaint, for instance, about sort of health and safety at work. And there are some technicalities which mean that that doesn't quite cover an employee who's leaving a job who wants to complain about discrimination. So that's not broad enough. But the point I'm making is that that exclusion, or that thing that you're not allowed to be silent about or to create an NDA about, has easily been accepted by industries, all sorts of industries. In fact, no one complains about it. It seems actually right and proper and moral. If you had a ban on NDAs about other unlawful behaviour like discrimination, racism, all of these things which are by definition of public interest, then I think very soon people will accept it and will not really understand what the arguments were for keeping them in the first place.
Yeah, and I mean, at the moment, in the meantime, as campaigners, we have the issue of even if an institution says, oh, we're not using NDAs anymore, how do we know? How can we actually keep tabs on that? It's impossible. It's really, I often get questions from journalists asking, you know, wanting to talk about NDAs. And I have to say, well, I'm sorry, I really don't know, because how can we know? How can we monitor this? So, yeah, there's quite a long way to go on this issue.
But I can also just say, as a mediator, because I've been a mediator in workplace disputes as well for about 30 years, you know, I know that there are fashions to what people use as leverage. And I know that sounds a little primitive and trivializing it, but it's true. You know, you go through phases of certain things being expected, and then that thing falls off the table and something else comes along. So this argument that the only way you will get them to settle is to give an NDA, you know, to me, with that experience, I know that's not true. I know something else will come along as a lever. And I think that, you know, it's important for us in the legal profession to recognize that that's the reality.
So there is one more theme I wanted to talk about before we wrap up in relation to your book and the tools that it gives us as activists, Julie. And that's about the role of insurers in sexual misconduct complaints processes. So I think this is something that isn't discussed enough, or hardly at all, really. So that's the insurers for the institution and the surprising amount of unseen power that they have in these processes. So it's really fantastic that you've highlighted this and discussed this. And there's actually two different examples in your book, both in relation to your university case, as you mentioned earlier, and also in relation to the Anglican Church. So maybe we could talk a little bit for the last few minutes about the role of insurers in these two different cases, and how we as activists, you know, whether we need to target insurers directly to try and get change.
Well, you know, we have to start by accepting that the sole reason for insurance companies to exist is profit. And so that means that their raison d'etre is payments minimization. So I think, you know, as activists, we have to be realistic about the fact that that's their goal. So in the case of the Anglican Church, the insurer, you know, chips away at victims, undermines their credibility. In fact, I'm very involved at the moment in trying to make them stop using a particular psychiatric so-called expert who produces the same report on every single victim, saying that whatever's wrong with them is probably because they had some, you know, accident in childhood that's got nothing to do with this. So, you know, there's a whole playbook here for reducing costs. And I think that it's important for us to be hard-headed as activists about that. You know, there's very few insurance companies that are out there to make the world a better place. They're out there to make money. But, and I think this is where you're right, Anna, that we have to pay more attention to the insurance companies. It seemed to me in my university case that the university insurers, and I actually thought this might happen at one point, but it did not, they need to figure out what to do about this. Because if university insurers, and in Canada, we just have one insurer for the whole country, all the universities, they're all public. If they continue to insure universities who continue to give NDAs, that continue to result in the kinds of outcomes that there were in my case, where eventually they were told they had to defend me, I think they might start to put pressure on their clients and say, look, this is just leading to a whole heap of trouble for us. They clearly did not want to defend me. And even when they were ordered to, they didn't do it properly. And I'm still hopeful that, not for the reasons that the three of us might have, but I don't care what the reasons are, insurance companies might still decide that if people keep challenging, and by challenging, I mean both directly breaking and also people outside the NDA, as I was, as a bystander, calling it out. If that continues to happen, they will find themselves in so many lawsuits that cost them so much money that they'll start telling their clients to stop doing it. So I do think that there is some strategic value in focusing on the insurance companies, but we have to be realistic about what their interests are.
Mm. So, Georgina, have insurers come up at all in cases that you've been involved in UK universities?
Yes, but not always. I mean, they always come up in the historic child abuse cases. Those cases are generally run by the insurance company. In universities, I've had a mixed bag, really. There's some universities that I think want to just insure themselves for this claim, perhaps. Maybe they want to have more control over it. Or perhaps, although they can make a claim, they are left to deal with it, to provide the instructions themselves, even if they're then being reimbursed. The settlement ends up being paid by an insurance company, but that's unknown to me. You know, I haven't been dealing with the insurance in lawyers, but with the university and their lawyers. So they're less prominent there, but I mean, behind the scenes, they're having to pay it. And I do think the bottom line for them is cash. And so if they're finding that they're having to pay out many times, they're going to be probably, sadly, more influential than us activists. And so that's why it's our imperative is to keep, well, I'm a great believer in lawsuits. I know mediation, most lawsuits settles. I mean, it comes to settlement and alternative dispute resolution eventually. But unless you bring the claim, you're not going to flag to insurers, to universities,
absolutely,
to people who are going to have to pay that there is a problem here. And so we have to keep bringing lawsuits and we have to enable them. So I think a lot of activism has to look at where the money goes, follow the money in a sense. So you've got to make it known to insurers that it's expensive for them to ignore this problem. And you have to, university, you have to not feel ashamed of getting compensation, even though what you've suffered often you can't translate into monetary terms. It's important that it is, because that's what will bring about change.
Yeah, and I wonder if there's also a kind of a public profile, a reputational issue for insurers. You know, there's all kinds of tactics that activists have used in relation to, say, you know, arms dealers or other large companies, such as buying a share, going to shareholder meetings and voting, or otherwise, kind of public action that reveals the role of companies in perpetuating harm. So, you know, if there's any activists listening to this, are there any, do we know what the insurers, main insurers are for UK universities?
No, I've had a range. I mean, they really are quite behind the scenes in the cases I've brought on. Right. And I've had a range of different insurers. So I wouldn't want to name.
No, fair enough.
I've got a few in my head, but I'm not absolutely sure that was a they were in university cases. I think the important thing for me is that often the university decision maker seems to be shielded by lawyers. And sometimes the lawyers are so obstructive, you wonder how this is possibly helping their client, especially as they will end up having to foot the bill. Someone's going to have to pay for all of our time going back and forth and teaching going back to the basics of textbook law as to why the university owes a duty of care to a student. And you wonder, is this really the lawyers coming up with these sort of ingenious obstructions, or are they being instructed by the university? Because ultimately the university does carry the buck for this. I mean, they are the clients, they can tell their lawyers to act in the defense in any way they want. And so they shouldn't feel that they can hide behind lawyers. But lawyers and insurers, it's all sort of one way in which universities can pretend their hands are tied and they're not pulling the strings. But ultimately they're the customer for the insurance company and the insured, and they are the client of the law firm that's acting on their behalf. So they do really bear responsibility for how defences are conducted.
Absolutely. And if I can bring this quickly, as a final point, Anna, back to my book, the tipping point for me when I was doing my case against the Anglican Church was when I received a letter from the office of the Archbishop of Canterbury, telling me that he was very sorry about this, but he really couldn't do anything because the lawyers were in charge of the case. Now, that was a very unwise thing to write to anyone, but especially to me, because anyone who knows my work knows I have been publishing books and articles for 25 years about the fact that clients give instructions to lawyers, not the other way around. So I think Georgina is exactly right, and I've seen this at the university too. The decision makers are letting themselves use the lawyers and the insurers, lawyers as an excuse. And I think that activists have to be very well aware that the real decision makers are the university management.
So I think that final point really gives us a taste of Julie's book and how, you know, with her decades of legal expertise, she was able to see through all of the bullshit and take these institutions on. So yes, I've been discussing Going Public, A Survivor's Journey from Grief to Action by Julie McFarlane. And it's been an absolute pleasure to have Julie and Georgina Calvert-Lee on here discussing this. I wish we could carry on talking for hours, but we will have to leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Anna.